Bah humbug. Pick up your popcorn. It's time for Hobby Support Group.
Good evening, Ed.
Good evening, Tom.
Hello, listeners. Happy Christmas. You're hopefully listening to this on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day, or at some point in the future. Who knows? It's up to you. But this is our Christmas episode for this year. And Andy has specifically said he didn't want to be here because he is a curmudgeon and a philistine of high art. And that is because we are talking about Napoleon, the film. But not the one you're thinking of. We are talking about the good version of Napoleon from 1927, which Ed and I went and watched the other Sunday in the IMAX. And we came out thinking, well, that's a Christmas episode sorted, because it was brilliant. In short, fantastic. If you're at home now, you can rent it off the BFI website for £3. It's 5.5 hours of your time gone, and it's well worth the money, I would agree. Would you agree, Ed?
I would completely agree. I had a great time.
So, happy Christmas, everybody. See you in the new year.
Yeah, Ridley Scott, never heard of her.
Yeah, so this is, and listeners, you are in for an absolute treat tonight of Tom and Ed try and pronounce many different names that we technically have prepared, but we will still see how badly we can butcher them. So, you know, do you want to start off with the director's name, Ed, or shall I have a go first?
Abel Gance?
We'll go with that. That's better than mine.
Yes.
It was 1927, Napoleon. Now, it's probably no shock to listeners that I'm a film fan slash fanatic, although admittedly, among my film friends, I am in like the Sunday league, you know, at best, you know, junior league. I think I've seen just over 200 films at the cinema this year. My cinema friends are all, you know, like touching 500, 600, 700. But, you know, I still think I'm an enthusiastic amateur. But I love a bonkers film, and this film blew my mind. I was going in expecting, I'd been told it was very good, but the person who did also recommend it me sort of recommended it me as a joke, sort of saying, oh, do you know next Sunday at the IMAX they're showing a 5.5 hour long silent film about Napoleon? And my immediate thought was, that sounds brilliant. I'm texting my friend to see if he wants to come. Luckily, Ed is of a similar persuasion. As soon as I text him, he was like, yes, let's go. And it's brilliant. I think I'm very glad you joined me, Ed. And I would say it filled none of the preconceptions I was going to go and watch it. One of the things I was particularly thought would be cool about watching it was realizing that, you know, it's filmed, you know, like 8 years after the Great War. Most of like the extras in there, but a great number of them have going to have like filtered through for Dan and have seen service. So it's going to make the military scenes quite more, in a way, more believable and more grounded, I think, than many other military movies that we see. And then you see the film and like, the Siege of Toulouse is horrifying, and I think it could only have been made and influenced by people who had experienced the Western Front. Would you agree on that one? And sorry, listeners, we aren't going to be going. This is Tom in charge now, so we aren't going from one part of the film to the other. We're just going to be zipping all over. But just if you've seen this film. It's in the mode of the film we're doing. Like, unfortunately, I can't split myself into three. I can't change colour. We've unfortunately got no eagles flying about. We're not going to be doing superimposition of things or super fast cutting. I think we'll just go through it theme at a time.
I'm currently podcasting from a swing.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that did blow my mind. But we'll get to that. We'll get to the cinematography bit. And we have actually got one segment where we're going to talk about how you can war game it. So, you know, if you are turning this off thinking, why am I I listened to a Toy Soldier podcast while they're now talking about camera angles and gel filters.
We're going to bring it back. We are going to bring it back.
We will, you know, make it a legally distinct HSG episode that there is at least some wargaming thing in there. But now, yeah, so... Yeah, did you think... What were you thinking going into watching this before we went to watch it, Ed?
Well, I've been aware of it for a while, and I'd seen some snippets online, and I'd always wanted to see it. So you messaging me, letting me know, I was like, yes, brilliant, let's watch it. Our mutual friend Greg had seen it ages ago and was incredibly impressed, especially by the snowball fight, which is right at the start, which is spectacular. I mean, it's both a really interesting war movie. So you see lots of battles, and you see that there's a kind of realism to those battles that you definitely get the impression that this is informed by people's lived experience of the First World War. And also, it's a really interesting experimental movie. There's a bunch of stuff that no one did before and quite a few people never did since, including having filming it, so it's on three parallel screens. So at the end of the film, you widen out to see the entirety of the army about to invade Italy, I don't watch as many movies as you do, but I like to think when I do watch a movie, it's a classy movie, and it is like a classy piece of art. I'd like to say I felt moved by it, and also I don't watch a lot of silent movies, and I think on a big screen you get some of the reason why people go on about silent movies being sort of really kind of heightened emotions. Like there's a particular scene where Napoleon is reunited with his mother, and all you're doing is watching a very large screen of a woman with tears in her eyes. But because of the context, and because, you know, that's all you've got, I was genuinely moved. I thought it was, yeah, no, it's an amazing film, and definitely recommend watching it if you get a chance.
Well, yeah, we went and watched it at the IMAX in Waterloo, which is, you know, the biggest cinema screen in Britain, and I think it was its natural home.
Yeah,
I don't watch many movies at the IMAX because it's normally really expensive, but I don't think you would get any of the grandeur of this film watching it at home on your TV. And like we had a little bit of chat about this before we got to watch it. I think one of the best ways to watch it at home might be on like a headset on your phone, so it sort of like encompasses your head. And like I can be like really, I will be now really pretentious and say I think this is one of the best films ever made. I think it is absolutely stunning, and I think it is one of those films that to say it's almost 100 years old does so many things, which was like, even if you watch something from like the 60s or the 70s, it's still seen as experimental, and yet this is doing it 50 years beforehand. And the idea of using three different projectors at the same time means you're able to use a lot of color in a black and white movie.
Yeah.
And I love a color filter. And so this has makes great use of them. And it is a very different type of filmmaking and film experience that will be Marmite to an awful lot of people, because you're not really there necessarily following the story as you are following the story, but it's very much like a experiential thing. So you're like, the idea is like in the old, like, especially like when they're singing, like the Marseillaise is sort of like teased out and sort of like to the point that where like, you know, you get a few words, then you get a few more words, but then like the music's on screen. And then like, apparently like when it was originally, sort of like filmed, like there would be some people in the audience, like there'd be people in the audience like handing out like billfolds with all the words on so people could sing along. So it is in a kind of way, it was filmed as a form of like immersive theatre sort of at the same time. And like the director who made it, like, oh, it's supposed to be like used on three projectors on a massive screen, but he also wanted it to be shown in stadiums.
Yeah.
Like, he's on the record saying, you know, films shouldn't be shown in small theatres. You know, we have 100,000 people watch football matches. As many people should watch films. And I think, like, there are so many scenes of, like, crowds which sort of, like, suck you in. I think as an audience, you sort of do feel like you become, like, one of the crowd. And, like, reading about the filming of it, of how sort of... you have these, like, extreme close-ups on people who you think are, like, main actors or, like, bit actors in there, but they're not. They're just, like... random extras in the crowd who are sort of like caught up in the euphoria and like the vibrance and the violence of whatever is going on at the time. And then they're sort of like, so like their emotion is on screen, even though they were never in, they didn't know they were going to have like a camera close up on them. And it's just mind blowing how cool that is. Like, especially sort of like the sequence about the Reign of Terror, I think is like one of the like best film sequences I think I've ever seen. When you have like the superimposition of like the storm of like Napoleon in his little boat, and then you have like the raising ferment of the crowd, and like then the descent into terror, and like, yeah, you then have the camera that's strapped to the pendulum, which I think zooms like sweeps in and out of the crowd. Like when we watched that, sort of like that did genuinely like take my breath away, like blow my mind.
Yeah,
of going like, that is so cool.
It's it reminds me of, there's a film I think from the silent movie, you probably know this better than I do, of Faust. I think there's a silent movie of Faust. There's probably multiple ones, but I saw it years ago. And equally, you have that impression of an old film or a classic film that is going to be quite kind of static or a bit staid. And this is a very action-packed movie. I mean, there are some bits that for a modern audience are a bit weird, or at least seem like they're from another era. There's a whole kind of subplot with this girl who adores Napoleon and then follows him to Josephine's house and then becomes the maid. And I think it must have been meant more to you probably if you were in the 1920s in France than it would to a kind of modern audience.
As an Italian movie fan in general, especially like Jello movie fan, I am completely at home with the like complete nonsensical subplot of like, which is you're used to at least one subplot. We should get abandoned halfway through. You should have one subplot that's kind of abandoned halfway through, and then, you know, 10-15 minutes after that one's been abandoned, you get the conclusion to another subplot, probably from another film, that's just kind of been like dropped in. You know, it's a new character, you've got no idea who they are, what's going on. You know, you're confused. But that's just like, that's a style of filmmaking that I love from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
I was quite pleased that this was doing it in the 20s. Like, how I would describe this film really is almost this, you know, if you got someone like Argento to remake El Topo, but in the style of a silent movie about the story of Napoleon, it kind of, because there were so many points of it where I was thinking like, this, it did make me think of things like, you know, yeah, so many of the Argento stuff with the bonkers and the colour filters and all that sort of stuff, but also just the craziness of what was going on screen, which was like, it is real-ish. But like the subversion of it and like the play of like, yeah, admittedly for a modern audience, the subtext and metaphor is, you know, it's a little bit, we'll say laid on.
Yeah, it's not like a subtle movie.
No, there's
Napoleon has a pet eagle, which recurs a lot. So there's just bits where just Big Bird says Napoleon, great guy.
Yeah, and then it starts off with that just as a child. Then when it's an adult, just you just get periodically, you just get Napoleon's face superimposed with the eagle. You know, they're one and the same. And then sometimes you'll just like morph inside to Napoleon's head, And then you'll just see it's Napoleon's head. It's just like the fire of revolution and like liberty inside his core of the soul at the same time. So, you know, it doesn't, as a viewer, you're not sort of left in like, make up your own mind about the moral standings of these sort of places. And like,
no,
I think what may be my favorite cinematic device I've ever seen in any film, or I think any piece of media at all. I know this. There was a hint to this at the beginning of this episode with the theme tune for today, was the impact of there's a character on screen who they want to get across the fact that they are slightly deranged or of more unsound mind.
Yes.
And so every time they are on screen, they are accompanied by a hurdy-gurdy player, which is then carried over into the score where you have the hurdy-gurdy player. And I think now, if I become independently wealthy, if I was an Elon Musk or one of these guys, whenever I did an interview, I would now be accompanied by my hurdy-gurdy player. But I do think it's such a brilliant idea that the hurdy-gurdy only turns up in for that one character. And, you know, you have, it's just brilliant. It's like James Bond villains of 1927. It's like, there's a wrong one. He's, you know, it's...
I thought there was something wrong with the soundtrack. Because you listening to the orchestral music, I mean, it's got a great soundtrack because most of it's Beethoven. But the you suddenly hear this hurdy-gurdy and it's really distracting. And it's for Robespierre's sort of descent. And it's the Committee on Public Safety. So whenever they're having their meetings, you've got this hurdy-gurdy player and they're going, oh, yeah, let's kill him. Let's kill her. Yeah, why not?
Or to the accompaniment of a hurdy-gurdy, which... I think if HSG had an instrument that was the official instrument of HSG, it would probably be the hurdy-gurdy or the harpsichord.
Certainly.
I think it's one of the two refined,
more
refined instruments. But yeah, I just think it's, yeah, this obviously the Beethoven score is gorgeous to listen to. And you know, jokes aside that it's 5.5 hours long, it's actually split into like four segments, four parts, which are unequally weighted.
That's certainly true, yes.
The first one's like nearly 2 hours long. The second one's about 45 minutes. I can't remember how much long the third and fourth one are. But it actually flies by.
Yeah.
And like we watched it in the cinema and I was not ready for it to end. I don't know about you. I was like, I'm...
Yeah.
But
It's sort of weird. It's got momentum like you're expecting it to continue. So it just goes up to the... First Italian campaign, you can tell the way that the kind of, I mean, it's a kind of crescendo of sound and visuals that you're following, and everyone's being as French as they can be, and Napoleon's, you know, got equations coming out of his ears, and you know, everything is being crowded on, and it's great, but at the same time, you can see. A bit at the back of my head, I'm thinking they filmed quite a lot of this, and I suspect they were thinking of making this into a further sequence. So there's a bit like the end of the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings, where they just, you can tell that they're kind of running out of rope in terms of their budget, and they want to cram in as much as possible.
Well, apparently with the Napoleon film, the original cut that was originally shown for 3 nights was 9 hours long. and then that was immediately lost. And then it survived for years as like a 3 hour film. And then since the '80s, one guy in his shed has been painstakingly like tracking it down and restoring it. And we now have the 5.5 hour version. But it was originally envisaged as part one of six.
Yeah.
So we've got like 5.5 hours of the first part. So there's supposed to be like, you know, easily like another sort of 40 odd hours. Because one of the things that like neither of us knew actually where it ended, and like I think we'd both seen the actual end, because like the end scene is a very famous scene, but you can't really sort of tell where it is. It was only about half an hour before the end, because we knew what time it finished, it kind of twigged, we're going to end at the crossing of the Alps.
Yeah.
And like I actually thought it was going to end on the famous painting, like a recreation of the famous painting.
Yeah.
But it didn't. So, yeah, it is a 5.5-hour Napoleon movie, which gets as far as the invasion of Italy.
Yep.
So, you know, Ridley Scott in 2.5 hours does everything. you know, 100 years ago, don't even guess where I was, Italy.
I mean, I think it would have been a different experience watching if he had the time and the money, and if, you know, it was released in the same year that The Jazz Singer came out. So talkies kind of completely upended his boat, as it were. But yeah, I think it would have been a harder watch, I think, for the later period Bonaparte stuff, because it's all very scrappy underdog kind of territory. So you can, it feels less bad when you're kind of papering over some of the things. Like, for example, you've got the 13 Vendémiaire, when he, that's definitely mispronounced, but Vendémiaire, where he famously cannons the royalists and guys on the street, rebelling soldiers. And that features very much in the Ridley Scott film, which I still haven't seen, but perhaps that's a kind of, okay, revolution's over, it's time for military dictatorship. You don't really see that. I mean, you don't see him cannoning people in the street. It's all like a logistical thing mainly. Like, oh, I need my cannons here and my cannons there. And, you know.
Yeah, he's, from the film we saw, there are no dictatorial bits at all, are there? He's very much like the folk hero who is saving France. And like, there are a few allusions, like, especially to, like, there's a sort of like almost like a gag when like his family are on a ship.
Yeah.
And it's like, it turns out that Nelson wants to sink the ship, and it's like, it's an unimportant ship. And there's like, there's three kings, two queens, and like an empress on there. You know, little did he know. It's sort of like, it's a quip in like a title card. Which is quite like, I don't know the period good enough, but I'm assuming that was invented for the movie.
I think that's actually true. I was trying to look it up because I think the Corsica bit, the Corsica sequence, had me kind of most puzzled about what was true and what was not true. Like, I think if you're Corsican and you're watching, you might be a little pissed off by the movie, because there's a bit where Bonaparte, where he's getting, the Corsicans are in the process of kicking out Bonaparte, and he storms into the, you know, main government building, tears down the tricolour and says, "You're not good enough for this flag," or words to that effect. And then in James Bond style, he uses it as the sail on his boat. I'm pretty sure this didn't happen. He uses the tricolour on, like I said, it's not a subtle movie.
Literally.
To escape Corsica.
Yeah, he escapes into a dinghy, but he's missing a sail. But luckily he uses the tricolour to survive a massive storm. And
it's like, there sort of isn't, but are undertones of kind of both, well, definitely overtones of nationalism. Like, this is a movie to be very French too. But at the same time, it's also overtones of, yes, he's the big authority and that is fine and that is appropriate. Like, there's a bit in the, just before the Italian campaign, where he goes into the assembly building, whichever one it is, legislature, and then he sees the ghosts of the revolution, and Saint-Just basically says, "Yeah, me and the lads have had a talk and we think you're it. You're the guy." Turns out we all reckon the revolution should end up with an authoritarian dictator, so have at it, lad.
Because we weren't, like, I don't think either, we were talking the breaks, like, we weren't quite sure of, like, what the politics of the film was.
Yeah.
Until we have the, like, you know, pat on the back from the ghost to the revolution, "You're a right chap, go ahead." Because we were like, what is this? And I think it's, like, not knowing very much slash anything really about the politics of France in, like, the mid-20s, I think it's, like, it's a lot of it's just gone over my head of, like, the subtext on it. But I think also you could possibly also read in a lot to it that might not necessarily be there.
Yeah.
Because I think it is definitely, like, a very highfalutin, like, very arty film, in that it's supposed to be a piece of art and not theatre. Now, that's also, I think, like, one of the reasons why it kind of failed to engage an audience at the time, and really has since, apart from people who, like, love film that are doing something different. And because it is a film that doesn't work on the level of what most film does. I've heard one film historian like describe almost as like the way the director sort of talks about what he was trying to do with it, with sort of like a, it's more like a collection of light, and it's like storytelling with light, and it's all about experiential and that sort of stuff. It's more like what people are trying to do today with VR.
Yeah.
So it's almost like rather than like trying to go in and like sit down and watch a film, it's almost like something that's just kind of like to bombard all your senses. And go, oh, I'm not sure actually what's, I'm not necessarily following like the message, like the full narrative on story or what was going on an hour ago, I can't remember. So it's like, I'm literally like enthused with like the fire of revolution and like the forge of revolution, because you know, this is carrying me away at this moment. And that's what I think it does like so brilliantly. Like you also have like fully engaged moment to moment.
Yeah.
And I think maybe like for an audience, like probably one of the great examples of this is the opening segment, which is a snowball fight.
Yeah.
And this is the bit that I now think war gamers could take, because I think I love the idea of selling to people, do you want to come and play like a 1-to-1 scale Napoleonic game in 28 mil? okay, come along. And then you turn up with 15 kids in a crater against 40 kids and they're having a big snowball fight. Which lasts probably, I'm guessing, do you think it's about a good half an hour sequence, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a long sequence, yeah.
And this is like, the film portrays this like Napoleon's first bit of like tactical genius.
Yes.
Basically, just the school teachers watch him kick the snuff out of a bunch of bigger kids to the point that one of them ends up like nearly paralyzed and in a sort of push sledge. Yes. It's a brutal school.
I think that probably was accurate.
Yeah. Like one of the great like little sort of like tidbits that you find that like the director actually wanted to put a camera in a football and then kick it at the children to film it. But unfortunately, the cameras at the time were too big. So instead, he just had to run at them with a camera. I think that snowball fight is... it's a brilliant fight. It is a proper battle.
Yes.
And yet they're just chucking snowballs at each other. Admittedly, like, two of the older children start putting rocks in the snowballs, then, you know, sneakily attack Napoleon with rock-filled snowballs. And then, you know, it's then, like, you know, again, not subtle on the foreshadowing. You know, of course, they're, like, named people. And then, you know, I think the title card is, as they would face each other across the battlefields of Europe, they did so against the schoolyard. But I think it would be a really fun game. I think a great like Christmas club game would be like the Napoleon snowball fight. so any of you who are good at 3D sculpting or, you know, sculpting, make us up some, you know, 1780s?
70s, 80s. I mean, 80. This is happening in 1789. If you know when Bonaparte was born, write it on a piece of paper and send it.
Yeah, how old was Napoleon? When was Napoleon? About 10.
I've got it in my notes. Hang on, I'll check my notes. Yeah, no, but around that time. So, yeah, definitely pre revolution, obviously.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Pre revolutionary French schoolboys.
Yes.
Now, that's the miniature that everybody is running off to purchase. Make us some of them so they can be having a snowball fight. Be great.
I think with scale creep, I guess some of the older like War Games Foundry ones, the proportions, you wouldn't have to do too much to like give them a bigger hat and then just say it's a kid.
Yeah, but I think, especially watching this film, like I've had a hankering for a while. Do I think because that some of the like the miniature ranges that do the like revolutionary like some of like the revolutionary war stuff, it's just you have just such cool characters about the time because they just look so much like Hogarth paintings come to life.
Absolutely, yeah.
And like there are so many like people sort of like there are so many stills you could take from this film and go, I just want like that dude as a model that I can like paint up. and like yes. that dude, you know, especially some of like the centuries and stuff where they've got all the big chest tattoos. Just like, oh, that's just, again, subtle goes here to die.
Certainly, yeah.
But
I mean, I think that, I mean, that's definitely a period that I would love to do in 28 mil. Some, I mean, there are people, again, War Games Foundry do some Revolution era models. There's an old company that was called Emperor Toad Miniatures, and I think they've been bought out by a subsidiary of Warlord Games, and I've completely forgotten what they're called now.
Yes, yeah, basically, or, I think,
possibly
it's something like that, isn't it? I think Shrex is something like, you know.
So there are folks who do it, and I think you can just do some work with just existing models. You just need to give them a tricorn. That the costumes didn't change that much, but at the same time, to get models that are really scraggy, like the Army of Italy, like I say, very much plucky underdog territory. Like you get, you know, they've got their ribs have been painted on with grease paint, so and half of them haven't got shirts and tearing clothes off each other and stuff when there's a fight. The I that would be a really cool modeling project. Unfortunately, it's down on the list, but I think at some point I would quite like to do a modeling, collecting an army for this particular period of late revolution, early revolutionary wars, just after the revolution.
Yeah, I think like a sort of just almost like a Reign of Terror era sort of like band of something. So you just got like a few characters who are just like maybe not a full army, just like a few random ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah. I think when we've spoken about this in the past, the idea of doing maybe like a slightly more skirmishy, because most of the mass combats, like the rolling civil wars in France at the time, are pretty grim to play out. That's no reason why you shouldn't do them, but at the same time, you'd have to approach it not in a kind of, you know, a gung-ho kind of a way. You'd have to deal with it as it was, which is like a really
properly grim
terrible guerrilla warfare, you know, the infernal columns, that kind of thing. The bits of France are still recovering from that, you know, in emotionally, and the, you know, I think you'd have to be a bit careful, but at the same time, it's on a skirmish level type thing, I think you could probably, there are games that you could play, you know.
I think you could definitely do like a Saturday afternoon ITV adventure series sort of version. Yeah. Set.
Scarlet Pimpernel, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That sort of set in that sort of period where, you know, maybe almost like a cross between like a role-playing game / war game kind of thing. And I think, yeah, setting it more in the, in like a cinematic universe than the reality, probably a bit more. It's easier to make it, well, I think you could then have fun with it, where certainly you can really have fun necessarily in the revolution. We can't have fun in many civil wars, can you really? There's not exactly hijinks and jollies.
Certainly. But if you were to do such a modelling project for that period, definitely watch this movie, because you get loads of inspiration for, you know, interesting characters.
And like, I think it might be slightly apocryphal, but like, I know one of the great the things that people say, if you want an example of like how Napoleonic cavalry sort of fought and looked like, really, look at 1914 French cavalry, because they're the same. And you've got to think, a lot of the people in this movie saw that. It is not only like within their living memory, it's probably within their service memory. Yeah, because you've got to imagine, like, most of the people on screen in this movie who are like over 30 have served it in the French army, which is not a million miles away different from the late Napoleonic era army. Like, you know, France obviously like lost the Franco-Prussian War, but its army was still, you know, very much in 1914 was still very much like a 19th century army in many ways. You know, now the French historians are now going to be throwing books at us, saying how wrong we can be. also there is some absolutely fantastic cavalry action in this film. I wasn't expecting to see a scene like a shot for shot like prequel sequence of from the Lord of the Rings films, because like when Napoleon is fleeing across Corsica, it can only be the sequence that Peter Jackson decided to recreate when Arwen is fleeing from the Nazgul in Fellowship of the Ring, because it is almost like shot for shot the same. It looks stunning. Turns out if you want really good cavalry footage, it's great just to chuck a massive film camera onto a horse, so you then get some crazy shots. Also some fantastic like carriage action to sort of show how Napoleon is in such like a fever to get things done. His carriage is too slow, so he's like just pulls off a cavalryman who's like charging past the carriage, leaps out of the carriage onto the mount, and then goes despite the carriage charging down the road. Prince carriage driving again, great scene. There is kind of something in this for everyone, I think, really. And like you can rent it for £3 off of online. You know, Google it. There's versions of it on YouTube. We're not going to encourage or discourage. But yeah, it's a movie that's almost 100 years old. But you get the like the remastered version off the BFI website for like £3. If you've got an all right telly, watch it. I'd watch it. In fact, I think it would be very hard, unless you're Andy, who is wrong on this, to be bored while watching it.
I agree. Yeah, I think even if you just wanted to select a couple of scenes to watch, I think it would be worth it. But ideally, watch the whole thing, because I think it's you won't regret it. I think in terms of battles, I think probably the one that you get the most of, and I think is the most immersive, is the Siege of Toulon. And that's also the one that I think we would, at the interval after that one, we were going, yeah, there are some World War One parallels, because it's filmed in the rain and there are people drowning in mud. You don't see it in as much detail as maybe you would in a modern movie, but you see enough to kind of get a feeling for, you know, what some of that stuff may have been like.
Yeah, I think it does very much get across the idea of how difficult it was to try and like fight a battle at night.
Yes.
And in the mud.
Yep.
And also like the level of casualties that were sort of sustained.
Yeah.
And it does. There are like the thing, like the scene, like I don't know how, because I don't know this period very well at all. Like, I don't know how much of the stories are like in the popular legend of the time or sort of like invented for the movie. But like something like the scene where like all the drummers are killed.
Mm.
And yet there's then like a hailstorm that then like hits the drums, which then like works as like, which is like the drum, which is then the rest of the units think that as their drum to sort of carry on, is the kind of thing that I don't know if that's invented for the movie, but it is very much the sort of thing that you would imagine does enter like popular parlance of like, oh, this was like,
yeah,
you know, it was it invented or is it the same as like the Angel of Mons? You know, it's the same, it, that sort of thing. And yet the idea of like what it's like to fight for like, you know, 76 hours or however long that sort of like battle goes on, you get the like the exhaustion of the men and like how they are just beat. Admittedly, it does then, it isn't a perfect sequence, because it then just sort of like slightly derail itself with someone then just, you know, a bit of like comedy relief of someone sitting on one of said drums to then get stabbed in the backside with a bayonet by somebody hiding under one of the drums and in the mud for some reason. And there is a very macabre bit in one of the sequences with one of the drummer boys who was, you're probably going to be dead by the time you're 13. was sort of like, well, good, I've got another 6 years to go then. That's, you know, yay, child soldiers. There are various little bits throughout it where it just, you do realise you're watching a movie from the 20s, where it will just have a bit of, it's 20s style comedy, which, you know, is a bit weird when you've been watching, when you've, you know, your brain's, you know, three quarters of the way to some other plane of existence from three quarters of an hour of what you've just watched, but then just watching somebody sit on the bayonet is, for comedy effect.
I guess you, presumably that would have gone down fine with the 1920s audience.
That's what they're there for.
Absolutely. I mean, you do get things like that which are jarring in even movies from the 70s. Like, I was thinking about the sequence in the 1970 Waterloo movie, where you have the very dated comedy Irishman with pig, and that whole sequence about stealing the pig, and then him having to answer to Wellington, who sort of looks down on him, and it's played for comic relief, but then you realise, doesn't really sit in the modern day. So I think there's always, but then at the same time with war movies now, they're always remorselessly grim, and there's a kind of, you know,
I think it needed, it needed some comedy relief. Is the wrong word to say when you just watched like a harrowing battle scene, but it needed a tone, and I think the way it's split into the acts works really well, because each act is like has a completely different tone.
Especially
like the third act, which is like the romantic act, or like the truly bonkers, like, oh, this is the random side character who is in love with his shadow subplot, which goes nowhere. Like, in reality, she should have sort of, it would have been, especially if this film had been made like 30 years later, she would have either then like conceived like spectral ghost child or withered away and died because of not getting the, you know, she was withered away from not being unreciprocated love.
But it ends with Josephine bonding with her about their mutual love of Napoleon, which is, I mean, I guess their relationship was messy to say the least. And it wasn't that long when he was off on campaign that she was having affairs. I think that's one bit of the Ridley Scott movie that I'm most interested in, is their weird relationship, although I think he plays Bonaparte is more abusive towards her in the open, which I don't think was accurate. But in the movie, it is although they do hint towards the fact that she was a lady with a history. Her relationship with Bonaparte is uncomplicated. It is a loving, adoring relationship. And I think that's very much the emphasis of that third sequence of the movie, which is probably the least. And, you know, we're men and we like toy soldiers. Probably this isn't the thing that's meant to be appealing to us in the writer's mind in the 1920s. But yeah, it did stick out a bit as the thing that felt a bit more removed from our experience as modern day folks watching a movie.
I quite liked it, because I think it had some like beautiful imagery in it as well. I think I quite liked, though, that they actually, like, the writing of it as well, though, did truly, like, set up the idea that, like, once he's married Josephine, he's basically lost his mind.
Because
he's, like,
yes.
Previously, he's, like, he's shown, like, just, like, he can't sleep, he's writing military plans, he's literally got equations coming out of his head, like, you look into his mind, and he's just got, like, he's envisioning, like, you know, the invasion of Spain, the invasion of France, like, you know, securing the France for the revolution, you know, invading everywhere. As soon as he's actually married Josephine, all he's thinking about is Josephine all the time, and literally then, like, you know, envisage the world as her head and this sort of thing. He's writing all these letters, and it's like, oh, I can't think of anything but you. You know, the world means nothing without you. It's been like an hour since I last wrote to you. It would have been interesting to see how that was going to sort of be, like, expanded upon.
Yes.
In future installments, because I think that is definitely like one of the like with my arty hat on, you could like, oh, is that one of the threads that it's sort of like setting up of like, oh, it's this man who is like unmanned by love or ideal or something, and you know, is this how like France itself lost her way by like, you know, what was the doing, like, because of where the film ends, it doesn't really sort of go anywhere, but yeah. it could be have been one of those like plot points that could be sort of like seed planting for something that could come into fruition in like 30 hours time.
Yeah. It must have been, yeah. I mean, there's some, I guess talking about it, and also after the movie, thinking about, well, I'd like to know about the context of this movie and what was, I mean, apart from, you know, trying, I mean, the overall message of the movie is it's trying to get you to experience these events. And that's, I think, what really appeals to me as a viewer to that movie. But there's loads of unanswered questions about what is Abel Gance's view of Napoleon, the long-term impact on France. What's the kind of expectation of a French audience in the 1920s of a movie about Napoleon? And yeah, I think there's, you know, it's that old joke about, you know, what do you feel about the French Revolution? It's too early to say. I think these things are like, that there's a long tail end to all these questions, which you're kind of left kind of pondering. But at the same time, the core of the movie is an experience, which you get in spades, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I would take, my takeaway would be, it probably is one of those things that if you're French, it makes you proud to be French, like especially at the time. It makes you proud to be French. And I think it sets the idea up of like, look, this is what like a band of like ragged, half-starved, ill-equipped, like broke, like, you know, people. Like, you know, this is like a ragtag bag on their, which, as they're going into Italy, and like, look what they achieved.
Yeah.
And I think you could definitely like have parallels of like, well, look at France today, you know, we're broke, we're threadbare.
Mm-hmm.
What can we achieve? You know, what was achieved like a century and a bit ago? Can we do the same again? You know, it then does ask like the uncomfortable questions of like, is it saying like we need like a new leader to like, you know, we need a new Napoleon to like rally around, or do we rally around France itself? Where does it sort of come from? And because I just don't know the period well enough, but you know, I don't know the period in France sort of at all. But you know, it's obviously like it's after the March on Rome, and that sort of stuff. So I think that's, you know, it's after like the Beer Hall Putsch and that sort of stuff. So I think it's definitely like, you know, revolutions are cropping up all over the place.
Yeah,
as they are. So I think it's probably a lot more sort of like in that, like the soup of the audience who are watching it at the time.
Yeah. And I think you're definitely left with the feeling that revolution is a period which you go through and then it stops. It isn't, you know, that there's, you know, a scene with Danton, you know, in a literal furnace.
Yeah, he literally says, doesn't it? It's like revolution is like the forge where you forge like a new state.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic scene. It's all red. It's mind-blowingly brilliant. But yeah, I think it's definitely like it is that idea of like, yeah, you do revolution, and then you stop. It's like
and authority is reimposed with a big bird and a powerful stare. And ladies love him. And
yeah, it's like, we're doing a revolution from 1 till 3:30. Then at 4:15, the buses are running again. We just need, revolution for a couple of days. Bins out on Tuesday, please, chaps.
So you don't have to, I think. You can leave some of that stuff by the door and experience it as a movie, because it's like I say, it's an exciting war movie. It's also like a really interesting visual thing. I was joking, the audience for it, when I got there early, felt very similar to a wargaming convention. It was a gentleman of a certain age in the pack of packs, me being one of them. But then looking at around the audience, I think there was a when we actually sat down to watch it, there's a wider variety of folks. I mean, people who are fans of cinema. And I think if you just want to watch a film that is historic and a beautifully made film, then it has that going for it.
Yeah, I think it's a fully enjoyable piece of art if you know nothing about Napoleon.
Yeah.
But if you don't like war movies, I think if you just like cinema or you like visual art, I think there's something in there for you. I think if you like Napoleon and you like war movies and war stuff, I think there's something in there for you. But I would also, you know, if you're watching it at home, there is nothing to be lost, possibly by sitting there and fast-forwarding a few bits and pieces. Like, no one's going to come around and, like, you know, tell you off that you're not sat through the whole 5.5-hour thing. Like, you will miss its overall impact, but I think its impact is quite often, like, it's in the sequence and it's in the scenes. Yeah. And if you're watching a scene and you're going, this is going on a bit, you know, feel free to fast-forward it a little bit. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like,
yeah,
I wouldn't, but then I'm a glutton for punishment. But hopefully, listeners, this has not been a complete waste of 50 minutes of your precious Christmas time listening to two folk twaddle on about a film that you're probably not going to watch. Although if there'd be a fire going out, you know, when I'd like several hundred more people suddenly watch it on Boxing Day, leave the family in one room, you know, sequent yourself to the viewing room and go, or gather all the children round. Go, we're not doing Call the Midwife tonight, everyone. We're doing this instead.
I mean, it's less bloody than Call the Midwife, I think.
Probably. There's no on-screen blood. It's all black and white. Although I do like one of the, some of the execution scenes are quite good, because you don't see any guillotinings.
No.
But you do see a couple of what are supposed to be heads on pikes.
Yes, you do.
We'll just say, like, some of the special effects work, the budget went elsewhere.
Fair. But then at the same time, I think heads on pikes are difficult because you don't want to make them too realistic, because then it is remorselessly grim. There's the French production at the time of the bicentenary of the TV movie, two-part TV movie of the Revolution, which I would definitely recommend if you've not seen it already. And they have a head on a pike, which looks it looks also a bit off. They've got quite a few heads on pike, unsurprisingly. So you don't want a head on a pike to look too realistic, I think.
I'm not a full gore hound, so it doesn't matter. I was just thought, you know, Napoleon's too busy to go and watch any of this because he's planning the invasion of Italy.
Yeah.
Despite, you know, admittedly his plan then gets passed, literally pasted over a crack in the window for several years. But, you know, he's too busy for that. But then he just sees what's going on when the head passes by on a pike. So anyway, thank you very much for joining me this evening, Ed. Hope this has been fun. Hope listeners enjoy it. And we will see you all. We will speak to you all in the new year. So happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you all.